Well, hello everybody. This isn't what we expected to be doing as we continue our journey through the text of the Ishak Hayil, or the Woman of Valor. Last week when we gathered, little did we know that we would be finishing the study together separately. But in a very real sense, we're still together, aren't we? And as I sit here, I miss you all. I picture your faces in our gathering space, and it's a little more difficult to speak without your responses and your smiles and your head nods and just the connection. But I'm going to do my best, and we'll move forward. The first thing I want to do is correct something that I said last week. I misspoke when I was describing how the word marvadim, that is the word for bed coverings in verse 22. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. We discussed the marvadim, the Hebrew for bed coverings. And I made a comment last week about the root of that word, which is ravid. And I took us to a passage in Ezekiel 16, where I said we can find that root in a word in verse 10, where God describes the clothing that he adorns and dresses his bride with. The actual word that is connected to the word ravid is in verse 11. It says, I adorned you with ornaments, put bracelets on your hands, and a necklace around your neck. The word necklace in that verse actually is the word ravid, which is more significant actually when we think about how God adorns his bride. I was thinking about Joseph and how he was given a necklace when he was put in his prominent and unique position in Egypt. And what that did was it set him apart and it distinguished him and it honored him. And it made him unique among the people. And I was thinking about all the times in the Word that God describes how he adorns his bride, Israel. And I was also wondering about the fact that it is a necklace which surrounds the neck, which we know always represents our speech. And it also represents the connection between the head of the body, which is our Messiah, and the body, which is us, his bride. Lots of things to think about. And as Grant and I were walking yesterday, I was asking him, what is it about adornment that there's a pattern of the masculine desiring to adorn the feminine or his bride? And God himself adorned creation with so much beauty. Did you ever look out and think about the fact that in order for nature to be functional, it doesn't have to be so beautiful? But God made all of the things that function in nature to keep life moving ahead, whether it's the trees or the flowers or the clouds or the water or the, it's also beautiful and colorful and balanced because he considers beauty itself as being functional. It's necessary and essential for life. And so when he adorns his bride, we see passages where he places necklaces and nose rings and bracelets and gold, and the women, when they came out of Egypt, actually took some of those adornments and brought them together to be melted down for actual worship within the tabernacle. It's all something really cool to think about. But what adornment does is it accentuates the unique beauty of each, doesn't it? And God does adorn his bride. And as Joseph was adorned with that necklace, just like we discussed how God takes the very armor that he himself wears and he places it upon us so that we can have defense and strength as we walk through this world. I believe the picture of Joseph as our Messiah, he takes his very own adornment and adorns his bride. with that which sets us apart and makes us distinct and beautiful. And he calls us his own. So I know that's a wee bit vague, just some thoughts that have been swirling in my head. But let's move on and begin the way we always do with just some prayer and focus time. And then we'll move forward in our text of the Woman of Valor. Our Father and our King, as we each sit in our own homes and we think about each other at this moment, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, we stop and we focus on you. And we invite you to speak to us during these strange and unique days of being set apart, of being quarantined in our own homes with our own families. We ask that you would teach us the things that must be so important for us each to learn during these extreme measures that have been imposed upon us. Lord, I pray we don't miss it. I pray that as we each take care to defend ourselves against physical germs and contamination, that just like in the physical realm, we would take even more care to defend ourselves against spiritual contamination and exposure to that which could bring danger not only to us, but to our family and to our households. I pray that we would each take these days and build up our spiritual immune systems, that we would drink clean water of your word, that we would feed on pure food spiritually, that we would begin to take notice of the people that we allow ourselves to be close to and to receive counsel and words from that could possibly spark a disease, Lord, in our souls that would make our testimony and our lives dangerous for those around us. So, Lord, as we seek to purify ourselves and to clean ourselves and to make ourselves strong physically, we do so spiritually as well. As women, as we look at this beautiful text that you've given us that transcends time and space, I pray that you would just enlighten us and speak as only you can, supernaturally. Send your comforter and your voice to the souls of each woman who are connected at this time through these words. And we pray in the name of our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen. So we are beginning with verse 26 in our passage. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. So our Woman of Valor opens her mouth, and she speaks with wisdom. She isn't uttering her frustration or speaking her tormented thoughts out loud like so often happens, but she's measured, she's instructive, and she is kind. Her tongue is not an instrument of retribution, or it's never an instrument for evil speech. She isn't looking for an opportunity to speak negatively in order to bolster her own ego. Isn't that what we do so often? She's always, always, at every moment concerned that her words are life-giving. Words. Wow. Words are so powerful. Words are intended to be the containers of truth, and they are intended to contain important life-giving messages. Think for a moment of the Word made flesh, the eternal Word made flesh, the ultimate example of how he possessed a true and life-giving message. His very life was that message. He was the truth and the life, or I should say is. When the Woman of Valor uses words to express herself, the self she expresses is wisdom. Consider this. She is always creative. Her words are creative and healing. After all, life and death are in the power of the tongue. We're told that in Proverbs 18:21. The practice of careful speech is called Shamarat Halashon, which means guarding the tongue. Pleasant words are indeed honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. We see that in Proverbs 16:24. There's actually another regal lady I would like to introduce. Her name is Lady Wisdom. We meet her in the book of Proverbs, but she's described in detail in chapter 8. If you're listening to this, what I would like for you to do right now is push pause and take the time to read chapter 8 of Proverbs thoroughly and become familiar with the Lady Wisdom. As we continue to talk about Lady Wisdom, verse 3 in that chapter, chapter 8, says, "Beside the gates, at the opening of the city, at the entrance of the doors, she cries out." Wisdom itself is personified as this regal woman. And when she cries out, this is so interesting, she allows those who choose to ignore her to pass her by. She does not chase them down and grab them by the collar and shake them and plead with them to listen. She offers great wealth to those who choose to respond to her and seek to know her. She loves those who love her. Think about that. But unfortunately, many choose to hate her. And in Proverbs 8:36, it says, "All those who hate me love death." As we return to the woman of valor, she speaks on behalf of wisdom. The woman of valor, as she speaks wisdom, does not coerce. She also understands the power of silence. Silence is a great skill that we really need to practice and learn. Wise women speak when when something needs to be said. Let me put it that way. Wise women use words when something essential needs to be said. Whereas fools just start to say things when they simply feel they need to talk. If solitude or silence is threatening to you, consider that you're afraid to be alone with yourself and with God. We tend to distract ourselves with babbling. Most of us tend to speak when we should be silent and choose silence when it's time to speak. Why is that? Well, I think that we are often motivated by fear and anger instead of love, and that causes us to just babble nervously and spew out words, trying to comfort ourselves or to affirm ourselves or to distract ourselves. I think that some chaotic souls love to stir up drama because it makes them feel important or included. But let's think about something. Love only cares about what is life-giving for the other. And remember, this woman of valor, our woman of valor, is dressed in strength and dignity, and she is not afraid. So not only are her words wise, and not only are they unselfish and loving, but they're kind. I heard an expert on marriage recently say that all the advice to couples can be boiled down to two basic words: be kind. Since kindness is on the tongue of the woman of valor, it is important to understand what it really means to be kind. What is kindness, biblically? Obviously, it can only be accomplished when wisdom is exercised, but what does it mean? Does it mean to be really nice to everyone all the time? The word kindness here, or chesed, C-H-E-S-E-D in the Hebrew, can be defined as generous, sustaining, benevolence. One who practices kindness is a giver and not a taker. Kindness goes beyond niceness. This is important, because it takes into account what is truly needed by the one to whom it gives. This type of giving is completely dedicated to benefiting the recipient of kindness with life-giving sustenance. Sometimes this can be done with a nice delivery, let me put it that way, but sometimes not. The one thing that true kindness will always be, though, it will always, always be fearless. True kindness, or chesed, is not concerned about making a good impression for the sake of winning popularity. It is motivated by unselfish concern for another, and it doesn't compromise the truth. Sometimes this can be expressed with what we describe as nice, and other times it has to be expressed with what might be described as sternness or an uncompromising stoic delivery, like we see the woman of wisdom described. I always say sometimes the woman of wisdom has to be mean in order to get her point across, which can be life-saving. Chesed is the quality that primarily characterizes God. Of all his qualities, he is ultimately characterized by loving kindness. When the Almighty descended in a cloud to present himself to Moses, we see the following. This is a very famous passage in Exodus 34, 6 and 7. The Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness, or chesed, and truth. Loving and kindness and truth go together. Who keeps loving kindness for thousands and forgives iniquity. And then that passage goes on. This text is referred to traditionally as the attributes of mercy. Yet we know that truth and justice can sometimes require a lack of niceness in order to display eternal kindness. What do I mean? Well, anyone who's ever witnessed a parent who's motivated by guilt or fear and indulges a child with constant niceness can truly understand the critical need for kindness. Kindness requires wisdom and fearless choices to truly meet the needs of others, including a spoiled child. Kindness isn't concerned about a person's wants so much as the needs. Great discernment and courage are required to exercise this brand of kindness, isn't it? When we consider that the teaching of kindness is on her tongue, the woman of valor, as she speaks, we realize that the teaching or the law, because it says the law of kindness, this is interesting to me. What is that law that is always on her tongue? Well, I believe that the law of kindness that is always on the tongue of the woman of valor is the Torah, which is the law or instruction. And the Torah really is kind. It's not always nice, but it's forever, forever kind. God's word is motivated by his desire for his children to live the very best version of their lives possible. That's kindness. He invites us into a personal and intimate relationship with him. That's kindness. The woman of valor proclaims this message with her life, and if necessary, with her tongue. Did you catch that? The woman of valor proclaims this message of truth with her life, and if necessary, with her tongue. One of Grant's favorite quotes that he shares about his mom is, she'll say, "Proclaim the gospel, and if necessary, use words." Something to think about. Don't think for a moment that this woman of valor that we have been getting to know is constantly with her tongue spouting religious jargon. Her words are in keeping with the authenticity of who she is, and she knows how to communicate without shaming, degrading, or self-aggrandizing. Do you know what I mean? I imagine she filters her words through the following requirements before speaking something. And this would be a wise filter for each of us before we speak. Here are three questions to ask ourselves. Ready? Is what I'm about to say true? Is it necessary? Is it kind? The world would be a much quieter place if we did the same. I want to present Queen Esther as an example of living out this portion of our text. consider how she is able to be discreet when it is time to conceal the fact that she is in fact Jewish. She was able to understand and to exercise silence for quite a long time. She was able to exercise discretion. Yet, she rises to the occasion to confront her husband, the king, when wise words are called for. When it's the right time, she's ready and able to speak. But we know that she had carefully taken her words, her message, through that filter we just mentioned. Is what I'm about to say true? Is it necessary? Is it kind? And she didn't worry about it being nice. And she didn't worry about how her words would affect herself. She was completely other-oriented when it was time to speak. The entire story of Esther is a lesson. It's a lesson about people who are spouting off without thinking, on one hand, like King Ahasuerus and Haman, while others measure their words very carefully. Mordecai, he measures his words very carefully. They're timed very carefully. They're delivered very carefully, discreetly. And then, of course, the heroine of our story, Esther. The restraint that Esther exercises literally saves the nation of Israel. This beautiful woman, after all, she beat out a pretty hefty competition in the pageant, didn't she? She's also composed, and she stands up to the officials that would make world leaders at the time quake in their boots or sandals. Remember the word for valor. Remember? Valor is a military word, and it denotes strength. Esther is truly an example of a woman of valor. I'm wondering if our definition for femininity as we continue through this text, is it beginning to change a bit? We defined our preconceived notions the first time we gathered. And we talked about how the word femininity has been so distorted, not only out there in the world, but internally in our own minds and hearts. So I'm hoping that all of us are starting to understand the biblical and godly definition of femininity. When we realize that both femininity and masculinity are expressions of God Himself, we begin to get a glimpse of a very powerful phenomenon, which is godly femininity. It is truly powerful. It's not the loud, brash, pushy, obnoxious version that we've been shown by foolish women, nor is it the fearful, timid, insecure variety that we sometimes see in religious settings. So, our woman of valor opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. You know what? Kindness itself is instructive. It teaches. It instructs, it corrects, it encourages, and it makes beautiful. She understands that discretion is a protection to her. Do you realize that? Proverbs 2:11 tells us that discretion actually protects. How many women and men, but we're talking about women and femininity right now, how many of us would do well to begin to truly understand the protection, the fence that discretion offers, and to teach our daughters? Our woman of valor avoids the pitfalls of tangled and messy situations which indiscreet words invariably create. She engages reality with truth and dignity, and she's able to give and receive words that are life-giving and build up the world around her instead of tearing it down. Remember, we either build up or tear down with our words and with our actions. The woman of valor not only understands the power of kind words, but she knows that silence is the fence of wisdom, creating boundaries and safety. I'm going to repeat that. Silence is actually the fence of wisdom, and it does create boundary and security. The craft of a person in this world is to behave as if mute. This is a quote by Shlomo Wolbe, and I'm going to start at the beginning. Listen. The craft of a person in this world is to behave as if mute. The craft is not to be a babbler. This is someone who has to learn. Since the baby learns how to talk, he babbles as if it pleases himself. Silence tends to be learned because silence is a great skill. And by it, you recognize the person of intelligence. The nature of a person is his solitude. I'm going to repeat that. The nature of a person is his solitude. We're all getting a little bit of practice about that, aren't we, lately? Only in that does the soul and spirit develop their strength. Only in solitude does the soul and spirit develop their strength. And that's the end of that quote. Think about what's been imposed in our culture and in our neighborhoods and in our homes as a result of the virus, the coronavirus lately. It's almost like an imposed solitude. We can take advantage of this to develop our soul and spirit, or it can completely expose our inability to appreciate and embrace solitude, and it can expose the fact that we're insecure and that we're not content. And that activity has been the thing that has filled the void in our lives for far too long. This is the moment to really understand and recognize that and to address it and do something about it. So as we continue to look at our woman of valor, she opens her mouth with wisdom and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. The Ishakhayel, the woman of valor, recognizes the power of words. She knows that a word is like a sword. A sword only wounds those in close proximity, but speech, it is like a sword that can kill at a distance. At the same time, words can be like a medicine, an elixir for illness. Healing words can travel a distance. And words not only transcend space, but also time. The following is a famous story that I've really appreciated for a while now. I'd like to share it. Some of you have heard it. It's worth repeating. And this is a story about the lasting effects of our words. It's a sobering story. Here it is. There once was a man who went around town slandering everybody, including his rabbi. As the man aged and came near to the end of his life, he realized that he needed to prepare to give an account for his life, and he also knew that his speech had been vicious. He went to the rabbi and asked for forgiveness. This wise teacher told the man that he would forgive him on one condition. He must go and collect feathers. And once he had a collection of feathers, he was to go around town and place one at the door of each person he had ever spoken evil against. This man, though overwhelmed by this task, was determined, and he spent much time and effort to remember each slanderous word he had spoken, and he placed many feathers upon many doorways around the town. When he returned to his rabbi after this exhausting task, he asked, "Okay, am I now forgiven?" The rabbi calmly replied, "Now you must go and collect each feather." "But that is impossible," cried the desperate man, "for surely the wind has blown them all away." "Precisely," said the rabbi. In other words, once a word has been spoken, you can't take it back. And even if you apologize and go and you collect feathers, it's already done its damage because it's blown in the wind and it's impossible to collect all of them. We have a story in the apostolic writings about a woman whose words gave life to an entire town. I love this story. And her words were the result of her encounter with the one whose words were living water to her thirsty soul. Though we don't know her name, we know that she had become despondent and wrung out as a result of years of abuse and neglect. If any of you have watched the series called The Chosen, this scene is depicted in the final episode, and it's, to me, the most beautiful scene in the entire series, The Chosen. If you haven't watched it, I recommend it. It's really well done. So this woman, the Samaritan woman, I suspect that she had lost her ability to choose well as a result of a pattern of really bad relationships. She was just kind of in a mess. And she was living with a man she wasn't married to. She'd been married 5 times before her current situation. And she encounters a man at a well. He sees her, truly sees her, and he engages her on a level that she had never experienced with anyone else. He actually reveals his true identity. The Word made flesh, our Master. He speaks truth to this battered woman, and she speaks life-giving words to many as a result of the words that he speaks to her. She runs away and she shares this message, and the people of Samaria invited the Master to stay and continue to teach them. And many came to realize that he was the Savior of the world, as is described in the 4th book of John. I love the story. After a candid description of the dangers of the tongue in the book of James, we're instructed about the true definition of wisdom in chapter 3, verses 17 and 18. It describes how it is made manifest by the words we speak. Here it says, "But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. The seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." That's about the best description of the words of wisdom that I can find. Once again, that's James 3, 17 and 18. I'm sure that that describes each word that the woman of valor speaks as she opens her mouth. And the law of wisdom is on her tongue. There's a quote by Aldous Huxley, and I think it's worth mentioning. It says, "It's a bit embarrassing to have been concerned with the human problem all one's life and find at the end that one has no more to offer by way of advice than this. Try to be a little kinder." That ends our discussion of Proverbs 17:26. I wish that we were all in the same room together so that we could chat about it a little more, but hopefully before long we can do that when we get to spend time together again. And I also hope that when we all regather, that each of us is going to be wiser and kinder, and that our words will reflect what we're learning while we're spending these days in this time at home in more solitude and hopeful reflection. But let's continue to Proverbs 31, our text, and the next verse, verse 27, says, "She looks well to the ways of her household, and does not eat the bread of idleness. The woman of valor looks to the ways of her household, not someone else's household. I want to focus on the word her. It's not her neighbors or her friends or even her kids' households. In other words, she minds her own business and she does it well. She minds her own business very, very wisely and carefully. Though the verse has been referenced earlier in our study, the following words ring loudly in my mind. It's one of my favorites. It's a verse that has become kind of a mantra that I repeat to myself at least once a day, and it's in Proverbs 14:1. A wise woman builds her house, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. I want you to think beyond our physical house. This word house obviously speaks of her life, her very life. So think of it as a wise woman builds her own house while the foolish woman tears her life down by her very own hands. There's a song many of us have heard since childhood. It's a wise man builds his house upon a rock. And we had little actions to go with it, our little fist bumps, and we would sing, a wise man built his house upon a rock. And those words became really familiar as we looked at the flannel graph of our childhood and we saw two houses compared. And we saw one built on a rock and then one built on shifting sand. We can read this in Matthew chapter 7, and I am intrigued as I looked at that verse. The Hebrew language, when it describes the contrast between these two houses, makes it clear that initially both of these foundations look pretty similar until the wise person who is building their house goes to the extra effort to dig down through that sand until they hit bedrock. I see the digging down through the sand as the person who sees beyond the surface of things in life and digs deep enough to find the bedrock of truth. The bedrock of God's eternal word, and then begins to build his life on that instead of just on the surface of things, like most of the people in the world who are building on sand. The point is this: we are each responsible to build our own life. We will each be responsible to give an account for what we have each done with what we have been giving, no more and no less. I don't know why, but it's always so tempting to try to fix other people's lives and ignore or resist attending to the brokenness in our own. We're all born broken. And each is given strengths to develop, and we all have weaknesses to overcome. An important part of our human mission is to bring restoration to the broken world. This pursuit is referred to as tikkun olam, or repair of the world. So how can we accomplish or contribute to repairing the world when what we've just seen is that God calls us to build our own house or our own life? I believe that the best way to accomplish tikkun olam is by fixing and adjusting and building our own life. I think the ripple effect of each soul fulfilling its own potential would bless, heal, and rebuild the broken world around us. I really do. This admonition should actually give us hope and direction. It releases us, it releases me, from the responsibility to clean up the messes of people around me. Because you know what? Unless the mess has been made on my watch, in my house, and is part of my own household, it's not my mess to clean up. It's tempting to think that if we don't help other people to straighten up and fly right, that they're not going to be able to know what to do. I'm speaking to those of us even who have grown children, grown adult children. How tempting is it to try to build their life, to build their house? The truth is, when I am living out the life God has given me to live and making the most of every resource He's provided for me, for my house, this will inspire others to begin to build their own lives. Does that make sense? So, am I trying to say that I think that we don't take notice of the needs around us? Of course not. But it does mean that we are not required to abandon the life or the house that we have been given in order to fix other people. I notice the tendency for women to ignore their own households for the sake of becoming involved in other people's business. And I do confess it. It's a peculiar pet peeve of mine. Just imagine for a moment that you can look through the window of your neighbor's house and you see a great deal of mess, of clutter, and dirt built up over time. And you decide you're going to help. So you march across the yard uninvited, you let yourself in, and you begin to clean and organize and throw away trash and rearrange furniture. And oh my goodness, would this be an appropriate way to behave? Is it really your responsibility or even your right to enter someone else's physical house and do that kind of work? Of course not. But somehow, we tend to barge into other people's lives and try to do that kind of work. Spiritually, don't we? And we excuse it as ministry. Let's reconsider the scenario another way. Your neighbor has taken notice that you seem to take care of things at your house, that you're typically happy and at peace. So they notice your house or your life and they're impressed by it. It's something admirable. Because you are busy going about your own business and doing it wisely and well. One day, let's say, you get a knock on your door and your neighbor invites you to come over and enter their house or their life, and for you to advise and assist them in creating beauty and order. Now, is this appropriate? Do you see the difference? When we're invited, it's different. I think of the warning about trying to remove a speck in my brother's eye instead of dealing with a log that is in my own. In Luke 6:41, we're warned about this. It's impossible to remove a speck in someone's eye until they agree to hold still, hold their eye open wide, and then let you get close enough and carefully to avoid damaging them in the process, remove that speck. In other words, counsel must be sought after and received with an open heart. If I take care of my own house, my own life, in a way that portrays beauty and hope to my neighbor, they are more likely to ask me to enter theirs and to explain how to build their own house on the rock. There's a fascinating warning in Proverbs 25, verse 17. It says, "Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house, lest he have his fill of you and hate you. This tendency to abandon the place or the vineyard where God has placed his people and he intends his people to flourish is not a new phenomenon. There's a rather dismal description of God's beloved bride or his people refusing to fill the space or the territory that was theirs to fill with life and productivity. And it's described in detail in Isaiah 5. Verse 9 begins. It says, "In my ears, the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses have become desolate, even great and fine ones, without occupants." These people had abandoned their own houses, their own lives. They had abandoned the place where God had placed them to fill with life and beauty. Despite what had been lovingly provided by God, they had stopped paying attention to the deeds of him, by the deeds of the Lord, it says. And they no longer had considered the work of his hands. They began to pursue their own, as it describes, drunken self-gratification. They were off looking for kicks, for busyness, for leisure, for fun. They had abandoned the very lives he had ordained for them to live. The light he had intended for them to be in the world, it says, had become darkened by clouds. That's in that same chapter 5 of Isaiah, verse 30. It had become darkened by clouds. In our time, I think the ability to become almost voyeuristic in others' lives is made even more common with social media, really. I mean, now we're inundated with intimate details of countless numbers of people every minute of every day. It requires a great amount of restraint to resist the temptation to continually look, compare, and even comment on the most trivial of daily personal thoughts and activities of other households. Time and attention can be drained from the reservoir of energy that God intends us to use in our own lives. Relationship quality becomes diluted to mediocrity, because we no longer have the ability to invest in the significant few that God has appointed to us. That is our own households. I think authenticity has been replaced with the phantom lives that people fashion and pose for others to see and hopefully admire on social media. It's just become crazy. But now let's think of people you know who have been diligent to make the very most of their own resources. Their homes are orderly and attractive. Nourishing diet and healthy activity come naturally to them. They've recognized their own uniqueness and they've developed certain abilities. They've developed those things. Each member of the household is noticed and appreciated and encouraged and brought to their potential. Home has been established as a safe refuge and a place to be restored for each person who enters, to be inspired. And it's also a place where hospitality is extended so others can be encouraged and nourished. Instead of chaos, there's order. Instead of a lot of noise, peace. And instead of selfishness, love. In contrast to our woman of valor who allows her home to be the center of her orbit of time and attention, we are also given a peek at the life of another woman, and let's call her Folly. She leaves her home, walks away from it, abandons it, and she does this under the cover of darkness in order to meet a foolish youth who's left the main road of life to seek her out. And we see this happening and described in Proverbs 7:10. She's betrayed her own husband. And the youth follows her because he does not know it will actually cost him his life. This woman, folly, brings death instead of life. This sobering warning is in extreme contrast to the kind of life we are called to live as women who are part of the bride of Messiah. Because returning to our verse for a moment, our woman of valor, she does not eat the bread of idleness. Let's think about the mezuzah, which is attached to the doorpost of the houses of God's people. It's intended to proclaim that the place beyond it, beyond the doorpost that it is attached to, beyond this threshold, is holy ground. You know, the world might be darkness, but our homes, they're to be filled with light. Truth and peace should characterize what happens among the inhabitants of such a place. Among the inhabitants of a place that has a doorway that is affixed with a mezuzah, which represents a message, doesn't it? But we cannot nail a mezuzah to our neighbor's doorposts, only our own. The woman of valor is diligent, and she looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. What is this bread of idleness? Does this mean she never rests? Is she always busy with activity? So let's ask the question, how does true rest, shalom rest and relaxation, how does that become idleness? What is the line? We know that though we're commanded to rest, we're also warned not to become lazy. I think the difference is partly in the motive. One can seek leisure and relaxation in order to indulge a selfish desire to just be comfortable for a real extended period of time. But another will take the appropriate rest in order to appropriate self-care, to be strong and healthy for the important tasks ahead. Do you see the difference? One might seek exercise and desire to diet carefully in order to, say, look really toned and sexy to get attention, maybe unhealthy attention. While another is going about the same kind of self-care and exercise, but they're motivated to be healthy and strong and at their best so that they can oversee their household with wisdom and diligence. You get the idea. Motivation is everything. I think, too, that an idle person is a taker instead of a giver. Idleness absorbs. It doesn't reflect life and light. I think that idleness wastes instead of investing and blames instead of being responsible. And we know from the word that idleness leads to shame and to poverty. In Proverbs 24, starting in verse 30, it says, I passed by the field of the sluggard and by the vineyard of one lacking sense, and behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. When I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked and received instruction, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, then your poverty will come as a robber and your want like an armed man. So we see there is danger in too much abundance and free time. And doesn't overabundance and leisure and free time describe so much of our modern culture, people we know, even ourselves? It's always a temptation to consider ourselves an exception. We think we can handle a little extra time, resources, money. It won't affect us badly. We think we can handle it. But you know what? The principles of wisdom in God's word are timeless and they're universal, and there really are no exceptions. We can try to deceive ourselves, but we are the ones who lose out on abundant life that's intended for us. We are the ones who need to understand that a life of humility and generosity is a satisfying and good life. A life of ego-driven ambition and selfishness is always, always a dead end. There's a description in Ezekiel 16, 16th chapter, 49 and 50, those verses. It says, "Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and your sisters had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease. But she did not help the poor and the needy. They were haughty and committed abominations before me. Therefore, I removed them when I saw it." I've read descriptions of the civilization of Sodom, and it is surmised that it had actually become illegal for anyone to exercise generosity, and that if you were caught exercising generosity, you could actually be killed for it. So we see this extreme description of how abundant food and careless ease culminated in a place where it became illegal to be loving and kind. But let's return to a positive and encouraging example of a woman who was not idle. She looked well to the ways of her household. We get a glimpse of this when we see the widow whose husband had left her. He had died and he'd left her with a debt and two sons to feed, which was disastrous in that day because it would mean that the sons could become slaves in order for them to survive, and that she would become a slave as well. In this description, the story is found in the second Kings chapter 4. This nameless woman of valor, I call her, rose up while it was still night because it was tough times. In other words, like we talked about a few weeks ago, she rose up while it was still dark in her life and it would have been easy to give up. And she took the initiative in the midst of her grief. And she approached Elisha, the prophet. She appealed to him and explained that her only resource was a jar of oil. Elisha encouraged her to borrow empty vessels from her neighbors. So yes, there is a time to appeal to your neighbors. And then to go back home and to shut the door behind her and her sons in order, in other words, to return to her own house, shut the door of her own house, and do what needed to be done for her own household. This is significant. So what she did in her own house with the immediate provision she had is she began to fill the vessels that she had collected with oil. She filled one and then another until they were all filled. And then she was able to sell the oil, pay the debt, and to continue to provide for herself and her sons with what was left over. The story amazes me. the amount of oil that God supplied, it depended on the amount of space that she made available by the vessels that she gathered. In order for God's divine energy and provision to flow, we must provide or become the vessels to receive it. We have to provide space for that. You see, the widow returned to her own house, and she made the very most of what she had, according to the instruction God had spoken to her. And as a result, she was given plenty. She wasn't destitute. She didn't become ashamed. She did what needed to be done within her own household. And we are still inspired by her life here and now. Imagine that. What if she had assumed that she was faced with so much scarcity and shame that it was hopeless? Whining and complaining would not have solved her problem. Discussing it with other people probably wouldn't have helped. We have to be very cautious about the counsel we seek. Waiting for someone else to come and take care of her business would have resulted in her sons becoming slaves. But she created space for God's presence to fill her life, and she occupied herself with filling the physical vessels with life, giving oil to sustain her household. This reminds me of a passage in 2 Corinthians 4, 7 through 9. It says, "We have this treasure in earthen vessels, so that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not of ourselves. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not despairing, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed." I think this is a perfect passage to end with today, as we are all in our own homes, surrounded by a situation that can feel perplexing, and we see what can turn into despair. Concern can easily become despair if we're not careful. Let's take this opportunity to provide space for God to fill, to be about the business of providing for our own households with all the resources that our husband, God, has provided for us, and to fill our own spaces with life, with love, and with everything needed to flourish. Not just survive, but to really flourish. And that is our study for today. We will continue with the next few verses next time. Thank you.